first-of-a-kind independent safety reviews of the Department of Energy nuclear weapons complex. And what came out of that in very general terms were some rather disturbing similarities between what was going on in Chernobyl, both technologically and institutionally. Fortunately, the N reactor, which had shared a similar design as Chernobyl, did not have the problem of a positive void coefficient, but it had no containment. But what was actually more disturbing was the fact that the DOE safety culture itself was scattered, fragmented, and isolated from the mainstream of evolving nuclear safety. That it was a problem where safety was not considered, you know, had its ups and downs, let's say, in the DOE, but did not have a consistent level of support over time. At that time, we felt it was important to establish some sort of independent safety oversight, so I was tasked by Senator Glenn to draft legislation of the first iteration of what is now known as the Defense Facility Nuclear Safety Board. That particular bill was somewhat different than what you are now working under. That bill was modeled to a large extent on the National Safety Transportation Board. It had binding recommendations and shutdown authority. It was hotly opposed at that time by the Reagan administration to the point where we were being accused of engaging in unilateral disarmament. We came within two votes of passing this particular bill in the Senate floor in 1988, I believe. But we had enough audience and support that eventually a bill was passed by the Senate Armed Services Committee in the fiscal year 1989 Defense Authorization Bill. It created the Safety Board and took some of the general features that we had, but also took out some of the key features that we thought were very important. One of the ones that we thought was an ongoing weak spot from my own personal perspective was the issue of how the department responds to recommendations. The Congress eventually basically set up a dynamic in the law that whereby if the board issues a recommendation and the secretary does not agree with that recommendation, it goes to Congress to adjudicate. And we're scratching our head and saying, where are their nuclear engineers and their safety people? They're throwing it into a political body that has no expertise to fix this. Fortunately, throughout the years, with the exception of Secretary Chu, as you may know, none of your recommendations have actually been challenged except for the seismic hardening at PF4. I thought the board, given those circumstances and lack of certain clout that we believe that should have been given, has performed a very important function over a period of several years now. And I think, as you clearly understand, the board's, let's say, in the short list of priorities, maybe number one, is to make sure the Department of Energy follows its rules. Now, the rules are oftentimes difficult to deal with because, unlike the commercial nuclear industry, the DOE, for the most part, manages safety through contract clauses known as orders. And these orders can be subject to change without public notice and occur at site levels even without headquarters understanding what's going on. I personally was aware of while I was in the Department of Energy, this occurred to us with the in-tank precipitation program at Savannah River, where Westinghouse suddenly had to raise a white flag because it was a multi-year failure after being told it wouldn't work. They kept modifying the orders. Headquarters was never informed. This led to the firing of Westinghouse by Bill Richardson from that project. But the department shouldn't be put in a position of using a meat axe to try to manage its contractors in this manner. I'm not faulting the board for this. I'm saying that this is the nature of the safety board regulatory regime. This is really one of the key structural components of the Cold War that has not changed. That there have been improvements, as you know. The board and others, DOE, has also done a great deal of its own work on its own to instill safety cultures, to instill some of the basic and elemental practices that are carried on by the commercial nuclear industry, the formal and disciplined processes, design safety reviews, etc., conduct of operations, conduct of engineering, these various aspects. And there have been improvements made. Having said that, I respectfully disagree that the board has outlived its function as a vestige of the Cold War, because to a great extent, the Department of Energy remains a vestige of the Cold War. And while circumstances have changed, as you know, the weapons complex, a lot of the major source terms, reactors, reprocessing plants, and the like, have been shut down for quite a while. Nuclear weapons production itself, in terms of new weapons, stopped in 1989. There remain a whole new set of challenges that are really associated with a large, oversized, antiquated infrastructure, and a system that never thought about having to stop and never had any contingencies to address the growing quantities of nuclear materials, fissile materials, and other nuclear materials. So now we have tons of plutonium in dense compaction in World War II era igloos at Pantex that now have experienced two historic floods, which I find to be mind-boggling that should be allowed to occur. I mean, I went and took the time to understand what the NRC safety regime would be for the storage of fissile materials, and this site would be immediately shut down. There is actually no buffer whatsoever allowing water to or to prevent water from escaping. And 6 inches of water in 2010 entered into the Zone 12 magazine. It was a 2,000-year flood. Well, we wound up with another sort of historic flood this August, flood of the magazines. These containers, the board has played a very important role in making sure the containers have been changed and more durable, which is a good thing. But the bottom line is that this has all been premised on the assumption that there would be an interim solution. There would be a disposition path whereby these excess pits or primaries would be converted. They would be, in this case, mixed with and blended into with uranium and into mixed oxide, burned in reactors. That disposition path has lost almost all of its credibility, and hence the likelihood of many tons of plutonium. And as you know, we're talking about plutonium. When I think about storing plutonium in a place like Pantex, I think about trying to keep track of a zoo of wild animals. There are different pits, different designs. They have different characteristics. Certain pits require a great deal of attention. Temperature is a very important concern. Some pits require air conditioning constantly. Temperature itself causes increases in temperature cause degradation of the pits, things like that. And I noticed that the contractor at Pantex keeps spinning out its plans for its 10, 15, 20-year visions. And conceptual design zero to replace Zone 12. I think the first time I saw a deadline on that was in 2008. I've not seen any CDOs for that. So I think you have to start to look at the possibility of indefinite storage of plutonium, and whether the adequacy of the current regime that the board played a very important role in is really suitable for indefinite storage versus interim storage. I took a brief look at some of the other sites, Y-12. Y-12 has a gigantic, as you know, oversized contaminated infrastructure. It's roughly larger than the Pentagon in terms of the footprint, especially the Alpha Building. And the Alpha Building is because it's so intrinsically connected to the central electrical distribution system of the entire site is no small feat in terms of its D&D. 9212, the principal foundry for HEU. As some of you may know, we spent a great deal of time looking hard at that, and the board did too, as with respect to criticality safety. It was in stand down for over a decade because of lapses in criticality safety. It is a deteriorating facility. Our HEU vulnerability assessment, which was released in December of 1996, got very little attention. And we could not convince OMB, because the door had been shut in terms of budget formulation, to deal with the problems inherent with that. Pointed out that there was a great deal of what we now call material at risk. We then called it in-process material. That was in 1996. I went and just last night glanced through some of the site rep reports and discovered you're having exothermic reactions going on with briquettes. This problem has not been fixed, these excess materials. The operational tempo of this operation is constantly disrupted because of equipment failures, age deterioration. But there has been, as I believe, there's been certainly an upgrading of the nuclear safety culture there, because it took 10 years of stand down to get these guys to a point to understand the importance of that. A Hanford worker once told me, it's a surprise when there are no surprises. And what we see at Hanford right now is another classic example of this large, oversized infrastructure that's now engaged and now in a state of rather very risky, incipient collapse. The Purex tunnel collapsed, much to everybody's surprise and consternation, because it was not on the short list of things to do. The safety board, as you know, has been very much involved in the trying to instill a strong safety culture relative to the design and construction of the waste treatment plant, a first-of-a-kind operation. I may also add that what makes the department a very unique challenge, in a way that has changed from the old days, I go back to the Manhattan Project era when they actually built pilot plants to develop proof of concept. We now are stuck with these design-build situations where the department goes to Congress with a conceptual design without any idea of proof of concept and gets multi-year authorizations, and then they have to work this through. And you can do, as you know, you can do design-build of a kitchen, but you're talking about a high-hazard operation with a melter, you know, running mega curies of material through it. Of materials that are really not adequately characterized to begin with because it's too expensive, is a problem. I was also very concerned about the fact that in the teardown of the PFP, the glove box of PFP, 31 individuals, employees, received assimilations of transuranics, principally plutonium, and that there was actually contamination from that event that resulted, was found in a public highway nearby. The workers and the public did not know, while the safety board reported that duly noted the event had happened, not the consequences itself, at the time, which the site reps did. The workers and the public were not made aware of this until October 7th, and the workers received a single short letter saying, here's your dose, trust us. And that does not instill a lot of confidence in the workforce. The PFP, one of the jobs I had for 5 or 6 years was auditing dose reconstruction for people seeking compensation under the Energy Employment Illness Program Compensation Act, EOPICA. And what we found, among the things we found, especially at places like Hanford and Rocky Flats, is that there was a great deal of high fired oxides that have very long retention periods in the body, that the biokinetic models that are presumed to be for plutonium just don't work. The people were found to be peeing out plutonium for 10 years after initial exposure. So the excretion curves that you assume are the standard ones are not the case. It's not clear that this plutonium has been characterized, these doses are accurate. I also raised a question in my mind, when you have 31 individuals who you suspect of, you probably had many more individuals who you suspected of having assimilations. Did they overwhelm the bioassay system? Were they late in providing bioassay kits? When did they collect these samples? Because this also affects dose calculations, you know, because dose calculations are based, again, on these extrapolations of biokinetic models. That, to me, struck me as an issue. I understand there's some sort of self-assessment coming out about that. But again, I sort of see this as an example of the current challenge facing the department, where there has to be someone looking over their shoulder. They can't be running, I mean, for the DOE to be running out there and saying, oh, the doses are so small, this shows that how well we do it with as low as reasonably achievable, everything's perfect. That's not the issue here. This should not have happened. The idea that 31 individuals received plutonium assimilations, albeit perhaps small, is not a trivial matter. And there needs to be some form of oversight here. I think the challenge facing the board, I think, continues. I think it has more to do with Pantex, the other issue about Pantex. One of the more interesting challenges that was given to me by Secretary O'Leary was that I had to recover gold and precious metals from dismantled weapons, which were the uncontaminated precious metals from the electronic packages. And what we discovered at the time is that they were just putting these electronic packages intact in barrels and sending them to classified burial ground at some enormously high tipping fee. And it took us quite a while to convince the contractor to go out and buy a 1930s era hydraulic hammer and to smash them into little tiny pieces and to sort out the plastics and metals and send a fee to a refinery. And we ultimately were able to return about $37 million in precious metal to the U.S. Treasury. I'm not bragging about it. It is one of the things I'm proud of, although I was not very happy about giving this job. One of the things I did learn about this was a significant breakdown of configuration management with respect to dismantlement. That when we began to ask for as-builts, because we wanted to know with some precision what the precious metal yields would be, we were met with responses like, what as-builts? It's not our job. The other contractors downstream are responsible for that stuff. And maybe the DOD tweaks these things and don't tell us. And so I duly reported this problem. And Secretary O'Leary, then sent a number of lab people to go down there to reconstruct the as-builts. Well, 2004, 2005, I'm dealing with this. And so I keep an eye on some of this stuff off and on, and I bump into an IG report of 2015 that points out that that 60% of the weapons flowing through there don't have as-builts. This is, you know, as you understand, you're much more intimately knowledgeable about dismantlement than I am at this stage, and you know that this is it's not working on auto transmissions. These are very sensitive and potentially risky operations. That the department has not fixed this problem indicates to me that they need adult supervision. The board, for better or for worse, is the only form of adult supervision that these guys have at this point in time. Now, in terms of my recommendations, the board, as you know, has its own independent authority to submit its own budgets. You know, you have to run through the gauntlet of the OMB and all these other things, but you're not part of the DOE budget formulation process. You should be fashioning budgets to match the challenge you're facing. You need to expand your site rep program. These guys, I think, are doing terrific jobs at these sites, given you have two people roaming the Hanford site, two people roaming Y-12, Oak Ridge, National Lab. There really needs to be a substantial increase in your site rep program. You need more eyes and ears. I also think that given the problem that is now, I mean, even the inspector, I find the inspector general to be the last guy to say something that there's a problem, quite frankly, especially when it comes to public safety, because they don't feel very comfortable. It's not their thing. But for them to come out and say that we have excess facilities that pose, quote, imminent dangers to workers and public is saying something. That requires, I think, a deep slice a look into that problem. Not just where the DOE offers up, well, here are the facilities we think are the problems. There needs to be some independent assessment of where these problems are. The board has been very good at its technical reports and looking at these problems in the past. There needs to be more activity in that area, especially with respect to these excess facilities. I think that at this time, any effort to dissolve the board or otherwise diminish its role is ill-advised. That ends my presentation.
Thank you.
Let's see.
Should I go ahead? We have questions at later, or you want to have questions now, Sean?
We're here to listen to you, and so we'll follow whatever agenda you have.
Okay. I'll try to be complimentary and not cover any of the same of the things that Bob has
not
covered.
Insult you like I have.
You're going to have to try a lot harder than that.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Probably know that I'm going to go way back to the first general counsel of the Atomic Energy Commission, Jim. That's you have some your cousin in the distant past in institutional terms. Observed that the nation's vast archipelago of atomic laboratories and factories, quote, was a separate state with its own airplanes and its own factories and its thousands of secrets. It had a peculiar sovereignty, one that could bring about the end, peacefully or violently, of all other sovereignties. So this peculiar sovereignty created and housed in the largely autonomous Manhattan Project under conditions of wartime secrecy and urgency was transferred after the war in part to civilian government and in part to corporate hands via the Atomic Energy Commission. It continues today in the semi-autonomous and also by U.S. government standards peculiar National Nuclear Security Administration. The semi-autonomous NNSA has in turn largely released the nuclear genie to its semi-autonomous contractors, which hold most of the political power in the government contractor relationship. I would also say that in degree, the power imbalance in favor of private contractors, which are now predominantly for-profit contractors, and the loosening of federal governance began approximately 20 years ago, although it was certainly present before. This new greater contractor independence from all federal control, not just safety control, is a feature of the environment in which the Safety Board now operates. It was not present to this degree when the safety board was created. A comment here from Steve Gadis, whom many of you know, who was at the Albuquerque office. He said to me at a break in a conference that, he said bitterly, they call it the nuclear security enterprise. Enterprise, that's the problem. When I was at Albuquerque, I could make one or at most two phone calls and make things happen around the complex. I could solve problems with one or two phone calls. Today, they can't do anything. Contractors now demand and receive, to a greater degree than ever before, not just freedom from external control and accountability, but also freedom from exposure of their failures, and are using their power in Congress to forestall embarrassing disclosures such as those that result from even the most routine and minimal reporting from the safety board. Already, most of the public transparency surrounding safety that once existed in the Department of Energy, which was limited at the time, it is now gone. NNSA is a uniquely troubled and hollow agency, largely run by its contractors, which spend about 95% of its funds. NNSA has approximately 20 prime contractor employees per Fed, and remarkably loose contracting and conflict of interest rules vitiate many of the ordinary rules that by which government operates. And this also occurs through the peculiar status conferred to the laboratories as federally funded research and development centers, as well as through special powers that are granted to the laboratory directors that lift them above the Department of Energy and indeed all executive branch control. I've learned this week that the NNSA laboratory directors literally sit at the cabinet table when nuclear policy is discussed at the principal's level, and which of course is their business lines. And while their technical expertise can in some but not all cases not be impugned, the conflict of interest is vast. The small number of contractors which are willing and able to do the M&O contracting work, when they sit down to negotiate contracts, the resulting contracts are weak, and as a result, NNSA and DOE are unable to negotiate strong contracts, and we have out of control costs, in our view, on both the weapon side and the cleanup side. And so the problems that I'm describing, that sometimes the safety board gets blamed for, are features of this peculiar sovereignty that results at really basically because the energy density latent in nuclear weapons is 10 to the 6th or 10 to the 7th times greater than high explosives. It's just a very powerful technology, and the government has had very difficult time controlling it. Needless to say, the safety advice proffered by the board, and that's really what it is, expert advice, and we think it is fabulous, and we have always thought it's fabulous, is hardly the cause of the NNSA contractors' many problems and failures. Quite the reverse. We believe better safety practices, and especially the early warning provided by the board, are essential for keeping NNSA's nuclear facilities running at all. And I frequently have said this, that without the safety board, we don't think that there would be continuity of operations at these sites at all. We think there... and we are not alone in this, that there could be not just worker killing, but complex killing accidents in the nuclear warhead complex. And you know some of the scenarios. We think they're real. the LANL caused deflagration at the waste isolation pilot plant, which we believed involved more violations of law than have been prosecuted or penalized, is just a taste of what could occur without the board. Actually, as Peter Niels, whom many of you, all but the newest people here know, he pointed out, there have actually been no contractor penalties at all in the strict sense, just a decrease in the profits and award term. Fewer carrots, but no real stick. I should add that the board's tiny and relatively disempowered staff was unable to prevent that accident despite their expertise and hard work.
Well, the board warned about the mine safety aspect of it beforehand.
The board did warn about that. But that building at Los Alamos where all of this was taking place was, you know, the board has to triage its hours just like we do, and neither the board nor the Environment Department nor the Department of Energy prioritized that operation. And as far as the contractor, they should have never created that last link in the chain of responsibility, subcontracting that out. And an accident will cost taxpayers a couple of $1 billion by the time it's all done, which is vastly more than the board's budget. So thus, in strictly fiscal terms, we believe that the board's expert advice, which is in part public, and I think that the terms, I think some, of course, has to be privileged and some needs to be public, dramatically lowers NNSA's management risk in its operating and its proposed nuclear facilities, and saves and doesn't cost money. And if you wanted to consider the board as part of an integral part of the nuclear deterrent, so-called, you could, because it contributes to the stability and predictability of NNSA's mission. I want to go on just one second about NNSA, which the contractors are not governed by the Hatch Act, which allows the huge laboratories like Los Alamos and Sandia, together with tens of thousands of highly paid staff, to become among the largest political donors in a small state like ours in New Mexico. The NNSA laboratories have public relations staff that dwarf the combined newsrooms of all the regional newspapers. Their lobbying budgets are huge. In these ways and others, such facilities capture civilian government on the state and even the federal level, weakening regulation where it should theoretically exist. As you know, they... So NNSA sites are exempt from nearly all actual external regulation, save for certain environmental laws, the application of which is spotty. Huge exemptions are carved out for special nuclear materials, which are often the greatest hazards to workers and the public on these sites. As the board knows, there is no actual external or independent worker safety regulation at these sites, either for specifically nuclear dangers or for more general worker safety issues. Worker hazards are routinely tolerated that would not be tolerated in industry or at ordinary federal facilities. I don't think even the military would operate buildings where hunks of concrete fall from the ceiling or where complete structural failure is expected from even a moderate earthquake with known recent faulting running directly beneath the building. Bob said, that the board issues advice to DOE, and that's all it really is, recommendations. Leaving Congress as the ultimate technical arbiter of safety should DOE reject the board's advice. It was a compromise, and it weakens the board's role. In this situation, which has come down all the way from World War II to the present, which protects these dangerous sites from most external regulation. The board is like the last straw. I think, conceptual frameworks that might be useful, some of it is the distinction between potentially high reliability organizations, such as might be, can be created in the military, where everyone must follow orders and there are strong consequences for that, and civilian organizations which have, as Bob mentioned to me earlier, must maintain experimental latitude in order to do the rest of their missions right. You're all familiar with Charles Perrow's School of Normal Accident Theory. And in the case of a laboratory like Los Alamos, I've now come to the conclusion, or did some time ago, but was the history of criticality, safety, reform, failure, which spans three presidents, eight area managers, two M&O contractors, and 12 years. I think in and of itself is illustrative that the laboratory is an institution which is almost canonically a normal accident institution, which requires significant external oversight and is unable to learn from its accidents.
We've got about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So,
For recommendations, just to quickly conclude, we would like to have more site reps, and we think you should ask for a lot more money, whatever you feel is politically feasible. When the safety board began, there was easier to get documents from the safety board that came from DOE, and they were it was very helpful and for people to understand what was going on. That is no longer so easy. Once a document crosses from DOE, should not let go of a document if it's not classified or official use only, then another federal agency should be able to do whatever it wants with that document. The DOE should not control things which have no stamps on them. We believe that at modern high-hazard construction sites, any worker can hold up a card and stop construction. And if they feel that something very unsafe is happening. And it's not really out of the question for the safety board to be able to have some kind of power when they see something that is really out of line. And I'm not sure politically how you could work this, but the safety board has gone through perhaps its initial life history, and we're in a new era now, and I think perhaps a little more power is. And I think there should be a life safety mandate. So this business of putting workers in unsafe facilities, which are a threat to life safety, even though the threat is not nuclear, I think that this is a loophole that somehow has to be addressed. That concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. Question for each of you, but let me start with Bob. Yeah. If you have a recommendation for Congress with respect to our statute and our
Power. Sure, it's going to be a tough road to hoe. You should be granted authority to stop work and shut down. Mm-hmm. You should have an expanded site rep representative presence. Those are the two things that come to mind. I mean, the other issue I wanted to raise as well is one of the big glaring weak spots in the Department of Energy is very poor conduct of engineering. Mm-hmm. They basically are hiring entry-level people to do work on first-of-a-kind high-hazard nuclear facilities with no on a design-build basis. My son-in-law worked for the nuclear Navy, naval reactors. When he was dating my daughter, you know, first, you know, had dinner with the parents and all that stuff, and got to know him a little bit, and I asked him, what do you do? And he said, well, you want my title or you want to know what I do? I said, both. He said, well, I'm responsible for instrumentation. But what I do...
What's his name?
Oh, David Torgerson.
Oh, I know Dave. I work with Dave.
Oh. Well, he's married to my daughter.
Oh, my God.
So Dave says, well, what I do...
Dan worked at NR2.
Yes.
You were at NR2.
Instrumentation.
Yeah. Oh, so you guys...
I work with Dave.
So I'll let him know.
Yes.
So,
say hi.
So... He says, well, what I do is I make sure these contractors flog themselves. And if they don't, we do. And here I am working in the energy department saying, my, this is a different world.
It is.
Totally different world. And because you have these people of quality who've come with the best, the naval reactors tends to recruit the top kids out of the engineering programs.
Sometimes they get damaged.
Sometimes they get guys like him. Sometimes they get like my son-in-law. But what happens with the DOE contractors is they come and go, and they bring in their entry-level people because it's a no-risk environment for their point of view. You know, they're indemnified for everything, for all their mistakes. And so there's been no real – there needs to be some form of certification – and some sort of detailed, much more detailed conduct of engineering requirements here for these, especially for UPF, for waste treatment plant, CMR, you know, all these new things that are on the horizon. Anyway, I'll stop with that. I didn't mean to go off on a tangent. But that's the answer to my question.
Greg, did you want to respond to my question? We need to leave.
Yeah. No, I would say that partly it can be done with the budget, but having expanding into the realm of actual regulation, I think there's a lot of misconceptions out there. So the Congressional Research Service, for example, wrote John Bedelia, who's was very experienced, years and years. He referred to the Safety Board as a regulatory body. And I think there's really misconceptions about that. So everyone expects you to be a regulator, but you're an advisory group. And
I'd just point out that by law, we are actually capped at 130 full-time staff. And while we're not at 130, if we were to take all of our contract support mm-hmm. and convert them to federal mm-hmm. positions, we would be at 130. Okay. So the only way we
is that a really, statutory cap?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The only way we can grow significantly, yeah. Mm-hmm. The only way we can spend money, mm-hmm. if we were to get more money, mm-hmm. would be for us to hire contractors.
Right. So the Trump administration...
What's that?
Or what passed Congress to raise a cap.
Well,
yes, or yes.
We're
yes.
talking about legislative change.
I mean, I hear you because, you know, there was a time when there were serious members focused on nuclear safety in the weapons complex. I mean, I was tasked to do this 24/7 in the U.S. Senate because my boss said this was a key thing. We need to be on top of this. We don't have that kind of oversight anymore. It's totally lacking, nor do we have the institutional memory or the expertise in the Congress.
Did you overlap with Jack Mansfield, over there in the Senate Armed Services Committee?
I was there with Madeline.
Okay.
And with Sherry Goodman mm-hmm. On Armed Services. Jack Mansfield, who became a member.
That's what I was talking about.
Yeah, Jack Mansfield when he was working for Warner. Yeah, sure, of course. Because there was this, you know, and it's not your fault. I'm not sort of saying it. It's just the way things are. But I must tell you that you guys are the only real open window these days to the public about what the nature and extent of the hazards are at this conflict.
So what I would like to say, first of all, thank you. I'm sitting here today because of your work and for the work which missions I support. What impresses upon me is that there's high reliability organizations. There's models out there by the American people, both in government and private, that have done a very good job, you know, executing their missions. You brought the Naval Reactors example, where people like Sean trusted their lives in the work I did, and others like
that.
Yeah. and in the commercial world, you have some pockets of excellence, but then there's something about the department complex that hasn't emulated some of those characteristics. It's like Americans do better and can do better, and I don't understand why it's not getting to some of the elements throughout the complex. That's bigger than the board. That's
I noticed that the Trump administration's budget proposal advocated for an increase in federal staffing at NNSA. And so the trend, which was ever downward, I think perhaps there's some recognition that has gone too low. And
I mean, one of the ideas that we toyed with before the end of the Clinton administration, which didn't get very far, but we recognized that the department did not have this same capabilities as naval reactors, and that was lost when the AEC was split up and NRC was created. But before that, the AEC did send kids to school, did train them, gave them career paths. They developed a knowledge base. They became cognizant managers. They were technically astute. And we started to have, a dialogue with then Congressman Duncan, the senior Duncan, on Armed Services at that time. This is long ago now. But it didn't go very far. But that kind of idea of being able to train people into this very unique, somewhat esoteric business is very important, because otherwise, the only other people you've got are if you can grab people from NR.
Well, they could also do something which they've been very reluctant to do, which is use the accepted service. To hire people for their technical expertise,
right?
Who are designed to be technical and not designed to be managers.
Be admin guys.
Right. Because otherwise, you get into the GS system to the.
Well, I'm afraid that those things are all usually precipitated by big accidents.
On the technical piece of it, if you go to any 10, any 20,
What I'm recommending, maybe you may think about, is being an overreach and pie in the sky, you know, given what you face. But and I don't know. I'm sort of out of the mix. You know, I have one foot in retirement, one foot out, and so I don't know what type of relationships you have these days with Hill, with the Armed Services Committee. There was a time when there were very strong relationships. I don't know what they are these days. The Senate always tended to be a much stronger supporter of the board. But there needs to be those kinds of ties strengthened.
In the commercial world, I don't know if you're familiar, they do plan assessments, and they do, you know, near the communities, and they do have this public meetings to go through the assessment of the plan in the past certain periods of time. Do you see value in a similar thing for the various sites, to your point of NSA?
Perhaps it's, I don't know what Bob may, I mean, it's hardly, it'd be hard to, for it to be worse than it is. Couldn't be worse, I think. They're just sealed off.
What do you mean it?
Oh, such practice of such meetings could only be an improvement from the present situation of almost complete closure.
Mm-hmm.
The sites, I heard this from a reporter yesterday, who feels like he's been blackballed by EM. they only want to get a certain message out, and everyone else is just completely blocked off. And
I'm
going to.
Could you restate the question? Restate the question.
No, the question is, in the commercial world, they do periodic assessments of the plants and
right.
public meetings near the communities and the sites.
Right, right.
Do you see any value of a similar arrangement for the complex?
Oh, absolutely. There is some of that that goes on through
yeah.
the advisory boards,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. but they've taken on over time more of an almost ceremonial function.
Yeah,
I see.
Yeah,
and they have become taken over largely by cheerleaders.
Yeah,
and are advocating certain things that department wants them to do, and that isn't that they're not totally sold out, but.
Yeah.
There is that.
Yeah, we are out of time.
Thank you.
Okay.
So if you want to continue a conversation,
yeah, sure.
Step outside the room. But I really appreciate you coming in.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for taking the time.
Opportunity to listen to you. And
so
we do have another group
talk.
That's going to come in here. Right?
Okay.
No problem.
Oh,
no problem.
Yes.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good
thank you,
you,
Bruce.
Thank you,
Jim.
Thank
you.
I'll be
best wishes, all of you.
Thank you.
And,
okay.
Yes.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Yeah, I would like to.